Okay, so sorry about that. That's an hour is more messing than usual. So, as I said, the good news is I had decided just to leave it at the Wi-Fi for today, which is will fit handily into the time remaining. Last time I was here, we were talking about sort of techniques for dealing with small scale fading, so spread spectrum techniques, including various frequency hopping and direct sequence spread spectrum, which sort of increased the bandwidth over which you were transmitting, orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, and then that combined with MIMO techniques, which attempt to sort of optimize the channels over which you're transmitting data. All of these, in addition to sort of trying to improve the quality of single channel, since they essentially define subchannels, can be used to increase your data rate as well. Okay, so we'll return to this idea of fading, and it's the interplays with these systems next lecture when we start talking about cellular systems. So fading is essentially the way we're what we assume in order to design our cellular architecture. For this lecture, we're going to look at, again, just point-to-point connectivity. And in particular, we're looking at wireless local area networks, so the IEEE 802.11 family. Okay. And the biggest aspect of this is the medium access control. So how do multiple users share the radio spectrum in this sort of a setup? Okay. So Stallings gives a fairly good overview of sort of the basics of 802.11. And the radio electronics tutorial talks about some of the more specific versions. Okay, and we'll say what we mean about versions in a minute. Okay, so we all have experience with Wi-Fi. Probably it's how your home network is enabled. Your smartphone will have both cellular and Wi-Fi connectivity. Okay. And so it's pervasive. Okay. And has all the wireless advantages, so we're not tethered to a wire. That means we have a degree of mobility. Again, our mobility is restricted to being able to stay within the range of an access point, so it's unlike a cellular system, it's not guaranteeing mobility over large regions. Having said that, you have systems like Eduroam, which will cover sort of the distance of a college campus, so it can go over larger, relatively large areas, but not sort of indefinite. It's fairly light on infrastructure. Well, you have an access point, which you then want to, you'll need to connect to some sort of backhaul network, but you don't have to, unlike cellular systems, you don't necessarily install permanent installations, and so this means that you can sort of deploy quickly and rearrange deployments quickly. The equipment is relatively inexpensive, mainly due to range issues and licensing issues. There's no requirement that you this works in the unlicensed spectrum, so there's less regulation involved. It's easy to hook up a bunch of wireless LANs together to, again, create a larger coverage area. And it's feasible anyway that you can do this and that you can use this to do ad hoc networking, so a controller-free environment. So we could set up in theory, we could set up the networking between all of our devices. Okay. The disadvantages, again, are that it's a radio link. So you can get high speeds out of radio links these days, but it's harder. The reliability is not as good as a wired link, so you are going to have greater loss. And again, probably a more unpredictable profile of loss. Okay. You have issues with security, so anybody can hear what you're sending. So you'll have to use some form of encryption, and whatever form you use is as secure as as it is. Okay. It has a relatively short range, so typically indoors you have 20 to 50 meters. And it wasn't designed, again, with the idea of blanket coverage in mind. Okay. So again, because you can hook up lots of wireless LANs and make them look uniform, we can cover areas like a college campus, somewhere that's sort of owned and controlled by a single entity and has an interest in that sort of coverage. But once you go your distance away, you're going to lose that coverage. Okay. So arguably it's the most successful wireless networking technology. So again, if you think that it's exists on most phones and then as its own entity, it is fairly ubiquitous. Okay. It operates in a license exempt band, so this is particularly in contrast to cellular networks, which are licensed and regulated. Well, this is regulated, not licensed. Okay, and like all networks, it is standardized, so the implementation and the protocols are standardized and allowing for interoperability. Okay, the body that standardizes, the standards are governed by the IEEE, and then within that, the Wi-Fi Alliance ensures compliance with, or certifies compliance with, those standards. Okay. So, yeah, we've already said that we do, the radio frequency bands in general are regulated, and many portions of the spectrum require a license to operate in, and then you would get those licenses from national bodies. Okay, so in Ireland it would be ComReg, in the US it would be the FCC. Okay. Having said that, there are portions of the spectrum that are left unlicensed, basically so that you can sort of have these smaller installations. The bands vary slightly from country to country, although, again, the ones that the Wi-Fi is on will be fairly common. So, since it is unregulated, unlicensed, you can't then control who uses those bands, so there are some limits put on the use, and that's specifically in the form of specifying a maximum transmit power. Okay, so what that does essentially is it's regulating your distance. Okay, so you can't just sort of increase your range indefinitely by just blasting out your signal. Okay. Why? Because obviously that would start interfering with other people who were trying to use this range. So you have a de facto limit to the range of your system. Since it's unlicensed, lots of different types of networks, lots of different technologies will use this band. So you don't just have wireless LANs, you have Bluetooth, baby monitors, digital phones, and even microwave ovens just emit in this range. Okay. So you are going to have sort of competition within the band. And again, hopefully by putting some limit on your transmit powers, you're keeping it the range small, and therefore limiting interference. Okay. So, there's basically two flavors for our wireless LANs. We can either have an ad hoc setup where everybody's talking to everybody else independently, or you can have an infrastructure-based setup where everyone is communicating via an access point. And this would be a more typical setup to use, because, again, your access point is allowing you to go out to the internet as well. Okay. In terms of terminology, we refer to the collection of stations that's communicating with each other as a basic service set. Okay. And your basic service set is going to then be defined by range. So you have to be within transmitting and receiving distance of each other to communicate, and possibly some sort of authentication as well. Again, if you have your standard wireless LAN, you're going to have to authenticate and prove your right to be to access the network. Okay. So the basic service set then is going to have a name. So that's the service set identifier. And it's going to comprise of a number of stations, users, equipment, and also possibly, if you have an infrastructure-based system, an access point as well. Okay. So, again, one of the things that's constraining a BSS is going to be range. You can't sort of go indefinitely far, either from each other or from the access, if you have an infrastructure-based one, from the access point. So if you want to define a larger network in terms of range, then we can have what's called an extended service set. And essentially, this allows multiple access points to advertise under the same service set ID. And so from a user point of view, it would look like a single network, and a user could move from one exit point to the next without having to change what they were doing. So in order to, again, from a user point of view, what they want to do is connect to the access points. Then we need the access points then to be able to communicate with each other. So if I'm here and I want to talk to a station here, I'm going to have to go through two different access points in order to accomplish that. So what we have to do at the back end is join together all of our BSSs to form what's called a distribution system. Okay. And so again, this is going to be some sort of backbone network which allows packets to be forwarded between access points, and so allows, again, from a user standpoint, coverage over the whole range of the network. Okay. And typically you have wired Ethernet backbone connecting all the access points, which are probably at relatively fixed positions. You could think about connecting them wirelessly as well, something like a mesh network. But a common setup, again, is to have the access points with a wired connection. Okay. What that means, again, from a user standpoint, is that the user gets coverage over a wider range, and without having to change what they're doing or reconnect, depending on what access point they have. Okay. So again, IEEE standardizes the protocols and even the physical equipment or the physical aspects. And
This is done under the family of local area network and also medium area network protocols. So essentially, IEEE has a large number of protocols that govern point-to-point connectivity. It's a single hop connectivity. And this includes our classic Ethernet, so our wired local area network, our wireless local area network, and other protocols as well, ISDN and ATN, which again are used point-to-point, or can be used point-to-point. And then it specifies a large number of physical options for how we can make that connection. So there's optical. You can have optical transmission. You can have radio frequency transmission. There's OFM, OFDM, DSS, etc. Okay. Now, 802.11 specifically refers to our wireless LAN protocols, and so again, within 802.11, there's a large number of different physical layers defined. These physical layers, again, operate in different frequency ranges and use different modes of bit transmission. Sitting on top of the physical layers is what's called the medium access control layer, and that regulates how multiple users share our medium. And typically, the two basic flavors of sharing are either contention-based, so in a distributed fashion, the users have to sort out who gets the medium at any given time. So that leads to sort of collisions and sort of back off the procedures to resolve these collisions or contention. So we'll discuss that later. The other option is that you somehow eliminate that contention through some sort of turn-taking mechanism. Okay. And for 802.11, there are options for a polling mechanism. So an access point can go from station to station to station, seeing what they need to transmit. And since that's turn-taking, you've got to move contention. Typically, what's implemented is the contention-based aspects. Sitting on top of our medium access control is logical link control, which just ensures the point-to-point transmission of packets, and that's uniform for all of the 802 family, which again, the 802 family is, the 802.11 is the wireless version of a greater collection of protocols. Other option, you have 802.16, for instance, WiMAX, but that's also a wireless protocol with different objectives, so it does not
trying to implement a local area network. You have 802.13, which is Ethernet, but that's wired, et cetera. So you have a lot of these 802 protocols. Our wireless LANs are all 802.11s. Okay. So it's a one standard or one family of standards, but there's a huge number of flavors within that standard, and these different flavors are referred to as amendments. Okay. So naming for amendments is done, so this is just something about the protocols themselves, is done per letter as the working group is established, not when it's finished, when the thing actually gets published. Okay. And these amendments can sort of specify the whole network or portions. So some will define the data link and physical layers. Others might refer just to the MAC, so things like quality of service is implemented by modifications to your MAC. That, again, can be applied to any of these standards. Okay. So this, some standards would be anticipated to operate in conjunction with each other then. So again, you could define a data link and physical layer like 802.11g, and then you could define some sort of quality of service mechanism like 802.11e, and they would be designed to work together. Okay. So, again, we have a number of MAC PHY standards. The older ones, the classics would be 802.11b, g, and a. Again, we can see roughly what our data rates are for those. They use different modulation techniques, and that's a combination of the modulation and the band they're operating on. They do get the different ranges. So again, B, G, and A would be the older standards would be relatively low performance. More modern standards then are the N, AC, and now there's an AD as well, which again would use OFDM and MIMO and would give us better ranges, more or less. The 2.4 always gets a better range than the 5, but you've improved your range within the 5. And, we're, again, getting a lot better in terms of data rates. Okay. Additional amendments, again, ones that aren't referring to the MAC and PHY, are our quality of service amendments, and we'll look at those in a separate lecture. Amendments that allow greater sort of networking capabilities, so again, from having a wireless LAN to having a multi, allow it to form up a multi-hop network. Okay. Okay.
So again, at sort of an administrative level, if I'm a station, this is a network, and so there's going to be some, I have to, A, be able to find the network, and B, authenticate myself within the network. So, assuming an infrastructure base, we have an access point emitting beacons in order to let potential users know that they can connect. Okay. So the beacons are transmitted periodically, every 100 milliseconds, and they are transmitted at the lowest data rate and maximum power. Okay, so that's going to give you your greatest range and your greatest possibility of being correctly interpreted. Okay, and so those allow the user to synchronize and to connect with the network. Users can either scan passively, or actively. Maybe with a passive scan, the user is waiting, listening for these beacon frames. Okay. If you are performing active scan, the users are allowed to send a probe. And if there is an access point, it can respond to that probe. Okay. From a user perspective, obviously active scanning is more responsive, but it's also intrusive, and it's adding overhead to the network. But it's typically these days you do use active scanning. Okay. Again, just because you found the access point doesn't mean that you're allowed to transmit, but you have to essentially attach to the network going through some sort of authentication procedure. So obviously usually when you find a wireless network, it's going to ask you for your username and password. Okay. So again, our wireless connections are not as reliable as wired connections in general.
If you remember back to discussing data transmission or the link layer within a wired framework, typically you had some form of acknowledgement of your packets, and so your basic option was a stop and wait, so you sent a packet and then you waited for it to be acknowledged. And that's what our older versions of 802.11, or ABs and Gs, use this positive acknowledgement. So you, every time you send a packet, you wait for it to be acknowledged until you send the next packet. Okay, continuing on from that, in a wired context, it was noted that that wasn't very efficient because you were waiting all this time to transmit, whereas if you assumed that things were just going on, they were going okay, you could transmit a number of packets before you had any hope of getting an acknowledgement. So you'd have either something like a go back in or a selective repeat protocol. So you were allowed to send multiple packets without receiving an acknowledgement. This was not allowed in our older versions because of the reliability issue. Yeah, you would lose sufficient packets that, again, it was not, you weren't going to get a savings by allowing for multiple acknowledgments. So that, for these older versions, is going to present some sort of limits on the possible efficiency. So, again, if you don't receive your acknowledgments, then you time. So either the frame could have been lost or the acknowledgement could have been lost, but you time out and then resend. So it's a relatively slow process. Our newer versions of Wi-Fi do allow for block acknowledgments. So they do allow you to send multiple packets before requiring an acknowledgement. And so that's due to the relatively improved loss rates and the faster transmission speeds make it desirable not to sort of continue on with this stop and wait. Okay. So, how do stations get access now to the medium? And again, there's two modes. There's DCF and PCF. So DCF is distributed coordination function, and it enables contention-based medium access. So again, if you recall, Ethernet uses what's called CSMA-CD, which is carrier-sense multiple access with collision detection, and again, a contention-based scheme. Wi-Fi uses a similar idea, carrier-sense multiple access with collision avoidance. The twist being that, again, you spend essentially more time listening to try and make sure that nobody's transmitting. Okay, so we'll go over the details of the scheme. Okay, but it's, again, your basic collision-based scheme where if you do collide, you then do some sort of random back-off procedure. If you have an infrastructure-based system, so you have an access point, well, then you can use the access point to coordinate amongst your users. And so basically the access point can implement some sort of polling system, so a turn-taking mechanism. You go from user to user to user and ask or allow them to send. Okay, so plus of that is that it's contention-free. Typically, that's not very widely implemented. And then you can do both sort of in successive intervals. Okay, so you can have some contention-free periods interleaved with contention-based periods. And the main attraction of that is that it does make quality of service easier. Quality of service is always easier if you don't have contention. Okay.
Okay. So, again, the two things to say about polling is it's not widely implemented, and it's fairly easy to understand anyway. Again, you just go from station to station to station, asking if they want to send data. To look then at our contention-based system, what we obviously want to do is to try and minimize the number of collisions we have. Things we'll see become complicated because there's no uniform view of what the stations perceive. Okay. So depending on locations of stations, they may or may not hear everything that's going on in the network. Contrasting that again with our Ethernet, the stations, everybody on the cable hears everything that goes on the cable. Here, if one person's at one end, one station's at one end, another station's at the extreme far end, they won't hear what each other is doing. So, still, you can only do your best. And so, if a station wants to transmit, it listens, so it tries to ensure that at least it can't hear anything being transmitted. If it doesn't hear anything, it starts transmitting. If the system is busy, then you go into your back-off mode. And if a collision occurs, you go into back-off mode. Once you're in back-off mode, you wait a certain time and then repeat the procedure. Okay. Did I not? Thought I had a... Bear with me, I'm just going to check. Guess not. Thought I had a flow chart of that. Okay. So, that's similar to, again, your CSMA CD. Again, the complication is that not everybody is hearing the same thing in the net. So, depending on the received signal, you have a certain range for each of your stations. You can again play around with that range by changing the power and possibly your signaling techniques, but you are going to have a fixed range for reception. If we think about here a node transmitting and then having reception being received. So NTX is transmitting to NRX. Then various other nodes are going to hear some or all of that conversation. So, EX, for instance, hears the transmission NTX. NH doesn't hear that transmission because it's outside of the
range of the transmitter, NTX. So again, you got it. You don't have a single view of the transmission shared by all of the stations. They see and hear different. They hear different things.
So this leads to two separate issues within the setup, what's called the hidden node problem and the exposed node problem. So the first one, the hidden node problem, we've said that NTX is transmitting to NRX. NH doesn't hear that. So it's not aware that this transmission is going on. Therefore, what we said was, you know, if NH wants to transmit, it listens. If it doesn't hear anything, it's allowed to go ahead and transmit. It won't hear anything, but NRX is going to be within its range. So if NH transmits, it interferes with this signal. So that's problematic, both in the sense it's unfortunate that NHX started its transmission, and it won't be aware that it's causing a problem. So that's the hidden node problem. Okay. We also have what's called the exposed node problem, which is, it's not as big a problem. The idea here is that, again, NTX and NRX is transmitting to NRX. In this case, NE, our exposed node, is aware of that. And so it listens and doesn't transmit. So in that sense, it's not a problem. But, again, there's a weird thing that could happen to the wireless system. If any wanted to transmit to some node out here, for instance, in theory, it could. As long as NRX is not within its range, then you could set up a second conversation transmission and not interfere with our original one. So, this is something that, again, couldn't occur in the wired network because everybody knows everything. But in this case, you could actually have simultaneous transmissions that don't interfere with each other. So it allows you to maybe optimize your transmissions. Again, if you're thinking about talking to an access point, that doesn't work because everybody's essentially sending packets the same direction. But if you had an ad hoc network, this can happen. Okay. So, again, to some extent, we want to increase our range as much as possible. And if we increase the range, we should have less hidden but more exposed nodes. And as we shrink our range, we'll have less exposed but more hidden nodes. So, what do we want to do about this? We can do what's called virtual carrier sensing, so we can set up a series of control messages that allow everybody to infer the state of the network. And so the messages we send are what they're called the request to send and clear to send. Okay. And so if I want to transmit, I listen, I don't hear anything, I send a request to send message. And then when I want assuming that our receiver thinks everything's okay, they send a clear to send message. And so this allows other nodes in the network again to have some view of this transaction. So if we look at our hidden node, it's outside of the range of our transmitter, so it won't hear the request to send. But it will hear the clear to send. Once it hears the clear to send, it knows that a transmission is going to happen, and that if it starts to transmit, it's going to interfere with that transmission. So that takes care of our hidden node problem. We also have our exposed node. Our exposed node will hear the request to send, but won't hear the clear to send. Remember, we said about this node is that it's within the range of the transmitter, but not the receiver. So it will know that if it starts up a transmission, it's not going to interfere with our received reception at NRX.
All of this is on the assumption that everybody's just within the one bandwidth.
Yeah.
There's no option to use it.
With the chip-top channels, but that's typical of these LANs. You end up on one channel and operating within that channel. So yeah, if you can hop, then you could do something else, definitely. Okay. So the other thing, that piece of information which is important for the RTS and CTS is that information is also given about how long the transmission will take. That allows nodes to, again, determine how long they're going to have to be idle for. Okay. So, timing information is contained in the network allocation vector, and this tracks the time the channel will be busy, and each station maintains its own tracking. And so this is the information received in duration field, so any frame is going to give you a duration. Okay. And then those duration fields are used to track, again, how long the station thinks the network is going to be busy.
So either I haven't heard frames, or again, the RTS CTS has that information as well. Okay. So there's no point in a station even doing anything, listening, sensing, while it knows that a transmission is taking place. So if a frame is being transmitted, if it hears that, or again, if it gets the RTS CTS, then it knows that the medium is busy and it doesn't need to do anything. At some point, obviously, it'll exceed that time period, and so that's an indication that the medium is idle, and so you can start your listening from that point. So that means that the stations are given explicit information about how long the network or the medium will be busy, and if they can base their operations on that explicit information. Okay. So if we look at, again, our request to send clear to send, the sender sends the RTS. Okay. And the receiver listens and then sends the CTS. And again, based on the information in the RTS or possibly within the CTS, depending which one of those your node has heard or received, the node will set there now accordingly. Okay. So the RTS and CTS are essentially giving you the same information about the duration of the transmission. Okay. The transmission then consists of your data frame, which will again give you that information, and then an acknowledgement, obviously. Again, if you're thinking about something and you translate it and acknowledge, you have to, the other notes have to be quiet for that whole cycle. Okay. Now, we've said that we wait a certain period, that we listen and wait, and there's different periods of time for waiting, depending on what's the nature of what should be transmitted. Okay. So, if you wait for different periods of time called interframe spacings, then the smaller the amount of time you're forced to wait, the more likely it is that you are going to be able to transmit your frame. Okay. So if I wait our SIFs and somebody else waits DIFs, since this is shorter, it's more likely out of it. I should be able to transmit my frame. Okay. So there are four different lengths defined. Short interframe spacing is our shortest, and it's used for the highest priority frames, which are essentially our control frames, so our RTS, our CTS, our acknowledgments. DIFS, DCF, IFS is sort of the basic, if you want to transmit data, the basic amount of time that you wait. PIFS relates to the point control function, and then extended IFS relates to sort of rarer events and sort of network maintenance.
Okay, so if we put all that together,
so then we start out at some point we get a frame to transmit, and we listen and see whether the medium is idle or not. Even if we don't hear anything, we still wait a certain period of time to make sure we still don't hear anything. Okay. Otherwise, again, everybody, the second you hear the system go idle, you don't start sending. So we wait different interference spacings. We listen again. We still don't hear anything, we can transmit. If at any point, if at either initially or after waiting, we hear that the medium was not idle, well, we should have gotten some information about the duration of the transmission. Added that to our nav, and we'll wait the amount of time till we think the transmission ends. Again, we don't want everybody jumping in at once, so we then wait an IFS. And assuming that we don't hear anything, we'll go into an exponential backoff. So at some point, the things were busy, and again, we don't want everybody jumping in immediately. So we try and randomize the time at which people start, and then eventually transmit our frame.
So
since we've added this interframe spacing in, the shorter the interframe spacing, the more likely you are to be able to transmit.
Okay. So once a frame has been transmitted, everybody waits our DIFS plus some randomized contention window. And as with
Ethernet, we start at a contention window of a certain size, so typically we start at 31, and then you'll get some sort of random time slot between 0 and 31. If collisions occur, well, that means that there must be a fair amount of people. Most likely there's a fair amount of people trying to transmit. So what we'll do is we'll try and increase the randomness, so we'll increase the size of the contention window. We essentially double the length of our contention window every time we have a collision. And so, again, if you've got a fixed number of people trying to transmit and you keep increasing the collision window, you're spreading out a lot the time at which they'll transmit, so it's less and less likely that they should collide with each other. Okay, that's goes up to a maximum size collision window. And you also limit the number of cycles that you're willing to go through. Okay, so if you successfully transmit a frame, or essentially you give up on the frame, then you reset your contention window to your minimum size, again, typically 31.
Okay. So,
again, there's any Ethernet-based system, any contention-based system, there are issues with efficiency. There are issues that you may never be able to transmit your packet in the worst case. Typically, they work very well in sort of lightly loaded traffic scenarios, and the more heavily loaded, the more inefficient they become.
So, again, all of that is medium access control is going to be governed by protocols, and so we need to have, you know, enough data transmitted or enough information given in order to sort of make those protocols work properly. So we're going to need all of this information about duration, about where addressing, what we're trying to do, etc. Okay. So, as always, information is contained in headers for a frame. The frame body is your data, it's your payload, and then you have a lot of information that's required to make the protocols work properly. Okay. So, if you were to go back and look up Ethernet frames, there's a lot less information attached to them, a lot more information attached to these. The one that sort of jumps out immediately is that you have 4 address fields instead of the usual 2. Okay. So the 4 address fields essentially refer to your sender and your receiver, and then the potentially 2 different access points that the sender and receiver can travel through. Okay. All in all, you have 34 bytes of overhead. Okay, so the first information is the frame control, and this indicates sort of again what use we're going to put the frame to. So the protocol version, the frame type, so you can have either control or data, and within that, sort of what exactly are you trying to do. So you can indicate that to your distribution system or from your distribution system, so are you using the access point to forward your packets to somewhere, or is it coming from somewhere? Things like fragmentation, so you can, for efficiency purposes, you might fragment your packet and get to the R. Is this a retry? So, you know, we only have so many of those
possible. Another thing, you don't get any internet power management, so again, what levels are you going to transmit at?
So, again, the main thing is just to note that there's a lot of different aspects to control that going on here that might not necessarily be present for a wired system. Okay. As we said, we always indicate our duration. Okay, so that allows us to set our nav and again let other users know how long the medium is going to be busy, and so that's sent in your data frames and also your clear to send, request to send frames, and finally if you're using polling, then it's used again to see how long each station needs the medium. Okay. So, again, since everybody can't hear what's going on, it's important that when they do get that information, that the duration is part of the information they get. Okay, so, again, we have four addresses, and so that's the sender, the final sender and receiver, the source and destination, and then any intermediates of access points that you're going through. And then you have your data field, so that's your payload. And sequencing information. Okay, so sequence control is used for detecting and discarding duplicate frames. So again, you number your frames. If you're using stop and wait, then you just that's easy enough. If you get multiple frames with the same number, you discard. And finally, error checking information using cyclic redundancy code, so using a block encoding. Okay, so we have, as I said before, three types of frames. We have our control frames, and the signaling that is used to manage the transmission of data, so your request to send, your clear to send, things like that. You have a data frame, so just carrying your data, and then you can have management frames, which are managing the station's connection with the network, sort of aside from sort of any sort of data transmission needs. Okay. So we don't need to go into sort of huge detail about these, but again, just to give you an idea of what control frames are. We have our acknowledgments, our clear to send requests to send. Indication about power savings and wanting sort of managing power while you need to send data. Then indicate and managing the sort of polling periods. Okay, so data frames, well, Yeah, there are 8 frame types, basically because you can tack control information on, you can piggyback control information together with your transmission of data. Again, that's not a surprising thing to do. That's done by all networks. Okay. And again, management is sort of managing the network connectivity, sort of aside from the sort of data transmission, but just, you know, allowing you to exist in the net, a station to exist in the network. So again, you have to join the network, so have some sort of authentication procedure. Possibly you have to find your access point. You have to join and leave the network, find access points, so any sort of management that goes on beyond transmission of data. Okay. So that's a fair amount going on. And again, if you were to compare that frame to, say, an Ethernet frame, you'd see there's a lot more data being transmitted. There's a lot more overhead to these Wi-Fi frames. Okay, so this leads us on to our question about data rates. And so why, this is actually what I asked you about in your second assignment, is why is your data rate lower than what is advertised? And well, the answer is essentially because your data is going through multiple layers of protocols. So what you really care about is the application data. But in order to transmit that data, we have to go through the TCP layer, TCP or UDP layer, an IP layer, and then a data link layer. And so one thing that happens, obviously, is that, again, each of these is adding a header overhead. But more importantly than the header overhead, each of these protocols has functionality. And again, that functionality doesn't happen just instantaneously. So, for instance, TCP, you have rate control built into TCP, so the congestion control. So in the presence of congestion, that's going to reduce the rate at which you can transmit and hence at which you receive. And at the MAC layer, obviously, if you have contention, that's the resolution of that contention is overhead and is going to impact on the final rate of reception. Okay. So, again, you have sort of 2 things going on. You've got overhead, which is, bits, but not useful bits, and then you have each of the layers actually performing functionality that will sort of have an impact on how fast the packets get to you, from sender to receiver. Okay, so
that's the MAC layer, and that's sort of, from a theoretical point of view, that's probably the most interesting thing about wireless LANs is how, again, how do you manage our access over single hop. In a sensible fashion. Obviously, there are other issues to address. We have security, and so the original security protocol was WEP, Wired Equivalency Protocol. That turned out to be not that secure. So, you know, again, it would take quite a short amount of time to crack that. And so WPA and WPA2 replaced WEP, and again, they're standardized in yet another 802.11, 802.11, 802.11i amendment. So this is not a module on security, so we won't, you know, just they're all based on encryption, and so some of them are good and some of them aren't. Okay. So the other sort of distinction for 802.11 again is the physical layer. And we have a convergence procedure that again unifies all of the of what's going on at a low level to send up something unified to the MAC layer, and then you have medium dependent, which is, you know, directly referring to how you're sending your bits. Okay, and we already looked, we already noted that, you know, we have spread spectrum techniques, OFDM techniques, et cetera. And if you broaden out to other 802 protocols, you get yet more different techniques. Okay. If we look at now specific channels within our bandwidth, B and G use spread spectrum techniques, and so they have a 22 megahertz bandwidth. And we define 14 channels, but it should be noted that you can't use all of those channels simultaneously. Within your bandwidth, there will be at most 3 non-overlapping channels. So you can get at most 3. And essentially what this means is you can have at most 3 access points sitting within close proximity of each other. Okay, now when you go to OFDM, what we noted last time was that OFDM allowed us to pack those channels in more tightly. Okay, so for 802.11a and AC, AD, all the OFDM versions, you get a lot more simultaneous channels. Okay. So again, lots of different physical transmission methods have been defined. Again, your more modern systems are all using the OFDM.
Again,
the first 802.11 to use OFDM and MIMO combined was 802.11n, and again, I had the goal of improving throughput. And so it allowed for increased channel bandwidth, so you would essentially use two channels combined together. And then MIMO again to try and improve your signal quality.
It used improved modulation and coding schemes, as we discussed before. And so it added again, it allowed for this combination of factors to try and improve data quality. So again, depending on your channel, you would use different modulation schemes. So try and encode more or less bits per signaling element. You can change, again, your encoding scheme, so add more redundancy or more overhead. Again, depending on the quality of the signal. Again, you could try to increase your channel bandwidth or increase the number of streams within MIMO that you're devoting to your signal. Okay. So again, you get a lot of possibilities for possible combinations.
There are 78 possible permutations with all of these factors taken into account. The first 31 fixed modulation type encoding schemes, and the remaining allow for different spatial streams to use different modulation encoding schemes. Your access points have to support the first 15 of these.
Your stations have to support the first 7 of these. Okay, so there's no real reason to
sort of belabor this too much. I just put these in just for interest. You can see again that the modulation is changing, so the number of bits you're encoding per signaling element is changing. The strength of the encoding scheme is changing. So 1-2 versus say 5-6. You can use 1 or 2 channels. Obviously, depending on encoding, coding rates, etc., you're going to get, and depending sort of how much bandwidth you have, you're going to get sort of greater or lesser data rates.
Okay. And so that sort of attempt to sort of improve data rates and continues for AC, which gives you sort of again gigabit Wi-Fi, and that allows you to aggregate more and more channels together to give to again a single user. Okay. You also have the possibility of more spatial streams.
And again, those can be used either to improve quality or improve data rates.
Okay, and that's continuing again to, increase the data transmission speed and quality. Okay, so
the main takeaway is probably for this would be the medium access control schemes and some general appreciation of again what comprises the standard. So it's the physical plus the data link schemes.
I've moved the quality of service support into, we'll have one lecture on sort of quality of service techniques for spanning various different networking technologies. So we'll look at what's done for WiMAX, LTE, and Wi-Fi together sort of in one lecture later on in term. So apologies again for the ridiculous wait to get started with the lecture, but we did fit it in a good time, and so I will see you guys next week.